From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, tracking jaguars, leopards, and tigers, Alan Rabinowitz is a zoologist whose mission is to study the habits of the endangered wild cats so that we can save them from extinction and save enough forest for them to live in. Also, we talk with John Prine, a singer-songwriter who's been recording for 20 years. He has a new record, and he just came off a concert tour opening for his old friend Bonnie Raitt. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest album by country star Garth Brooks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Magic Johnson, who has been a leading L.A. Laker for more than 10 years, including 5 championships, has announced that he's retiring from pro basketball because he has tested positive for the AIDS virus. At a news conference at the Forum, where he played for 12 seasons, Johnson made his announcement, which was carried on CNN.
I'm gonna miss playing, and I would now become a spokesman for the HIV virus, because I want people and young people to realize that they can practice safe sex. And, you know, sometimes you're a little naive about it and you think it could never happen to you. You only thought it could happen to, you know, other people and so on and on. And it has happened, but I'm going to deal with it and my life will go on.
Johnson said that his wife has tested negative for the AIDS virus and that it was discovered that he had the virus when he was tested for a life insurance policy. In addition to being a leading basketball player, Johnson has been a corporate spokesman and a role model for young people. A Pentagon investigator believes that American prisoners were left behind in Vietnam after the pullout of U.S. troops. He gave testimony today on Capitol Hill. NPR's Brian Naylor has more.
Garnett Bell, the head of the U.S. office in Hanoi for POW/MIA affairs, told a Senate committee looking into the issue yesterday that based on the evidence he's gathered over the years, as many as 10 U.S. servicemen were left behind in Vietnamese jails. The Pentagon had declared after the 1973 return of U.S. prisoners from Vietnam that all had come home or had died. Today, Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams was asked to explain Hill's statement.
This is preliminary judgment that Americans were held prisoner after Operation Homecoming in 1973. He also said he does not believe that U.S. policy officials at the time knew that Americans remained in captivity.
Williams says Bell will be continuing his investigation. Today, the Senate panel heard from a Vietnamese defector who said that no living American soldier is being held by the Hanoi government. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Also in Capitol Hill, the House has approved a major civil rights bill that makes it easier for victims of job discrimination to collect damages. The measure was approved by a vote of 381-38 and now goes to the White House, where the president has said that he will sign it. In Canada, Parliament has approved a compromise gun control bill by a vote of 189-14. The measure bans the import of military assault weapons, makes it more difficult to get gun permits, and raises the minimum age for gun ownership without parental consent to 18 from 16. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 15 points to close at 3,054. This is NPR News. Abortion rights supporters have asked the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on whether it still stands by its 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling that guarantees women a right of abortion. A coalition of civil rights and women's groups say that they believe the High Court will overturn its abortion rights ruling, and today's action increases the chance that a decision could be handed down before the 1992 presidential election. At issue in the petition filed today is a Pennsylvania case in which a federal appeals court has upheld new state restrictions on abortions. In Yugoslavia, the Federal Air Force has been in action over Croatia, bombarding military and civilian targets in violation of this week's latest ceasefire. The Serbian-led army has issued a new call for the city of Dubrovnik to surrender. Pierre Vickery has more on the story.
Air raid alert sounded in 24 Croatian cities as the Yugoslav Air Force launched one of the heaviest bombardments. bombardments of the war. Dozens of civilian and military targets were reported to have been attacked with missiles and cluster bombs, including an airfield north of the capital Zagreb and an electricity substation and ammunition dump at Delnica near the port of Rijeka. Further south, pro-Serbian troops besieging the medieval city of Dubrovnik issued a new ultimatum for Croatian forces to lay down their arms. Zagreb Radio quoted city authorities as saying the ultimatum would be ignored. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
According to the Soviet news agency TASS, a Soviet passenger plane with more than 30 people on board is believed to have crashed in a mountainous area in the southern part of the country. The plane was on a short flight of some 300 miles when it disappeared from radar. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down. I'm Ann Taylor, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Alan Rabinowitz is a New Yorker who spent the better part of the past decade in the jungles of Central America and Southeast Asia. Rabinowitz is a zoologist. His mission is to save the jaguar, the leopard, the tiger, and other endangered wild cats, and to save the rapidly disappearing forests they live in. In the mid-80s, he lived among the Mayan Indians of Belize, tracking jaguars and establishing the world's first jaguar preserve. That's the subject of his book, Jaguar, which has just been published in paperback. In 1987, he was invited by the government of Thailand to study the habits of tigers and leopards so the government could assess how much of the forest would have to be preserved to sustain the cats. This work and the adventures and mishaps he had along the way are covered in his new book, Chasing the Dragon's Tail. The wild cats he's trying to save are the top predators in the forest. When the top cats are gone, is there a change in the forest?
There is a change, actually. And that change can be seen in the United States, where we once had pumas roaming and wolves roaming areas, and now there are too many deer which need to be culled, or they're becoming so abundant that there are problems in certain areas where people live. When you lose your top predators, the animals which they feed upon, which are usually, in the case of things like tigers and jaguars and other large cats, they're mainly larger deer species, those animals start to become much more abundant because they're not under a strict control, and the weaker numbers of those species and members which were previously sickly and had parasites and would easily be taken by the larger cats as food, now they're also breeding as well as the stronger members of that species. So what you're getting actually is a weakening of the wildlife food chain when you lose your top predators, because your top predators, like the cats, serve to control all the things that come underneath it.
Now, you have an interesting technique for studying and tracking large cats. You attach little radio collars that have little transmitters on them, basically. Would you want to describe what you do there?
Okay, the animals which I study are species which have never been previously studied in these forest areas where I work. And the reason for that, which include my studies on the big cats of Thailand and the jaguars in Central America, it's all the reason that these animals have not been studied previously is because they're very secretive, solitary forest animals. And you cannot just walk in back of them and follow them or watch them or easily come upon them, even if you're tracking them in the forest. The only way to study them is a technique that's been around for quite a while now, nearly 30 years, called radio tracking, radio telemetry, where you actually capture the animal using some kind of a trap or snare, and you drug the animal, put the tiger or the jaguar to sleep, and then I attach a radio around its neck, and this radio is made as small as possible according to what the weight and the structure of the animal is, and this radio then will allow us to track the animal, to actually be following it in the forest, though I rarely ever see it again. Once I capture one of these big cats and set it free, it's very unlikely actually that I see it once again, because even when I'm tracking it and I try to come up very close to it, they're always one step in front of me, and they escape. they go away. So very often I'll be tracking these cats, and then I'll turn around to go back to my camp or to my field station, and I'll find that they've been tracking me. They would have circled around, and they're in back of me. So these radios will allow me to follow them without ever really seeing them again, without ever needing to see them again, though I try to, and I would very much like to see them in the forest. But it allows us to follow them, to find out exactly where they go and how much forest they use, what size forest they need. That's why this technique is so important. The reason I study large cats, which many people ask me, many people ask, why do I love large cats so much, or cats in general? And in actual fact, it's not the cats per se, which I love more than any other animal. It's that these large, wide-ranging predators are so important to saving the remaining tropical forest in the world, because they need more forest to roam over than any other species. But the only way to try to justify saving large areas of forest with governments, especially poor governments, is to say, well, if you truly do want to save your jaguars or your tigers, here we can show you that so many tigers need this amount of forest. And in order to find out exactly what that amount of forest is, which is usually a huge amount of area for the big cats, we need to put these radios on them and track them.
In your new book, you write that every time you capture an animal, you know, capture it so that you could just put the radio transmitter around its neck, that you have very mixed feelings. Can you describe what those mixed feelings are about?
Well, I love wildlife. I love animals. That's why I study them. Quite often, I think I love animals much more than human beings. That's why I first entered this field. So because of that, my ideal in terms of studying animals is what most people's ideal would be, and that would be simply watching them or being able to get close to them, possibly even touching them. But I don't feel good about affecting their life in any way. Now, we've done this kind of technique, radio tracking, putting on drugging animals and putting on radios. I personally have done this for over 10 years now, and it's been done for nearly 30 years with many species of animals. So we know that if properly done, the animals are not hurt by it. But frankly, I also know that putting on radio still does affect them in some way, because I could see the change in their eyes, and I can sometimes even see the change in certain patterns of behavior when they go out. So I don't always feel good, though I know it's necessary, because there's no way we would be able to study them otherwise and get the data we need to protect them. It always saddens me when I capture something wild and free and I sort of leave my mark on it in the form of a radio collar, because then it's marked for good.
Yeah. Well, you know, to clarify, before you could put the radio collar on, you lay a trap for the cat, and then when they're trapped, you give them a tranquilizer so that you can attach the radio collar, and then you set them free. Now, early on in your work in Thailand, something went wrong with the trap, and it caused one of the cats to die.
Right. That was not a trap, though. That was a snare. That was what's called a cable snare, which actually I had very mixed feelings about using, because we know in the past there have been instances. Now, a cable snare is simply, it's sort of a modification of what hunters use in the forest. It's simply a snare set out in the underbrush. It's not something which an animal cannot see. It's set along a trail or a road where you know a big cat is walking, or an animal you want to trap is walking. And when the animal steps inside of that loop which the snare is made into, the snare closes around its ankle, and you capture it. Now, some animals, when they're captured, simply lie down and wait and don't fight. Some animals fight, and it tends to cause injury. In general, with the cats, we've had very mixed results using these kinds of snares very often, but more often than not, the cat, because their paws are so sensitive, that they will generally just lie down and not fight the snare. But in a few instances, they will fight and injure themselves. What I didn't expect is I got a cat. My first capture was used with a snare because we were building the large box traps and they weren't ready yet. And all I had was a snare, and we had found a big cat's kill, a tiger's kill, and wanted to try to capture that cat immediately. And I thought a lot about it because it was a choice of either waiting till that trap was built and then just hoping that we would find a fresh kill again and be able to capture that cat, or taking advantage of the situation and going after it immediately with a cable snare, which I knew I had more than 50% chance of it coming out okay. Well, it worked against me, and it was totally my fault, because I think it was a wrong choice, and I will never use a cable again. It was a big male I caught, leopard, and he fought the snare a lot. And the snare did not wrap around his ankle. It wrapped around three of his toes, because as he had stepped in the snare and the snare started to close, he pulled his paw quickly upwards, and it closed around three of his toes. He tugged and tugged at the cable snare, because it was only 2 hours after he was caught till I reached him. And he tugged at the cable snare so much that it ripped through his skin and caused a fairly large injury to his paw. But that isn't really what killed him. What killed him was the shock and trauma of being captured in that cable snare and fighting it for more than 2 hours. And then when I got to him and I drugged him, and I saw that the injury was nasty, but it wasn't bad enough to cause the animal to die in the forest, because it was an area where the animal could clean and it would heal eventually and the foot wasn't broken. But I didn't count on trauma, and trauma is something that will often kill wild animals because they're not used to being captured and kept by man. So what eventually happened is I put a radio collar on him. I didn't have a cage or a pen to keep him and watch what would occur, so I had to make a decision to radio collar him anyway and hope that everything would be okay. And I radio collared him and followed him 4 days, day and night, and he eventually died, unfortunately.
It was suggested to you that the reason why this leopard might have died was because you didn't make an offering to the mother spirit of Dancing Woman Mountain, where the preserve was. So you thought about that and ended up making an offering to her. And I was wondering what went through your mind in deciding whether you should, you know, make an offering or not. I mean, it's part of a series of beliefs and traditions that you're not really a part of, but a lot of the people who you worked with were.
That's true, especially in Thailand, especially in the forest areas. Virtually everyone there believed in spirits and ghosts. And any place that you would go in the forest where there were people that were there, they would have these little wooden spirit homes, houses, for the mother or the father of the mountain. Usually it was for the mother of the mountain, because the mother spirit is seen as more powerful than the male spirit, actually. So at my field station as well, there was a little spirit house for the mother. In fact, my field station was called Dancing Woman Mountain, and that was for the mother of the Dancing Mountain. Whenever anything went wrong, not just this cat dying, but anything occurring, if a man was injured or something occurred in relation to my project, they would blame it on the fact that I hadn't made the proper offerings, or that I didn't truly believe in the mother of the mountain, because they felt in order to do anything in the forest that you had to ask permission of the mother. So, in fact, when this cat died, the men I worked with, the Thais, were very angry at me, because they don't feel that the cat should have died and that it wouldn't have died if I had made the proper spirit offering.
So did you make the offering for the sake of the people who you work with, or did you start to believe in it yourself?
Well, at first, when the cat died, the offerings which I made were strictly for the people, because they would no longer work for me unless I followed the proper protocol with the mother spirit. And as time went on, and in the course of 2 years, many strange things occurred in the forest, and to be honest with you, there were times when I wondered what was real and what was not real. Not that I came to believe in it eventually, but I came to realize that there was a lot out there I had no idea about and couldn't rationalize in scientific terms.
I think what you were supposed to give in the offering is a sign, one sign of how, you know, the modern world intrudes on the traditional world. That your offering consisted not only of pigs' heads and chickens, but whiskey and cigarettes.
That's right. Because after you make an offering to the mother of the mountain, you let the mother feed upon and smoke the cigarette and drink the whiskey or feed upon the offering for about an hour or so, and then it's okay for you to eat the food. So whenever I had to make an offering, the men made a shopping list to make sure it included a lot of the things that they really liked and couldn't afford normally either, because we would always get to feast upon it as well afterwards.
So is there a certain brand of cigarettes you're supposed to use for this offering?
Yes. Actually, when they offered it to the Mother Spirit, it would always be a very cheap brand. And when I had to make an offering, I had to go out and buy a very expensive brand of cigarettes.
Well, there you go. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Rabinowitz, and he's a research zoologist with Wildlife Conservation International, and he's written a new book about his work in Thailand to try to save the large cats there. It's called Chasing the Dragon's Tail. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Zoologist Alan Rabinowitz is my guest, and he's the author of the book Jaguar, about trying to save the wild jaguars in Belize, and he's also the author of a new book about trying to save the large cats in Thailand, and that's called Chasing the Dragon's Tail. For some people, this would have, like, symbolic value. You ended up getting caught in one of the traps that you had set. You were actually trying to unfasten a pig whose harness was caught on the trap, and the trap got your leg and broke a bone. What went through your mind when you were trapped by one of your own traps?
That was a strange experience for me. In the 10 years I've worked in the forest and I've trapped and radio-collared animals, that kind of incident has never occurred to me, and I've never felt that kind of fear before. One thing I'll clarify is that we use live bait in these traps because these big cats will only come in and feed upon live bait in these forest areas where their prey is normally relatively abundant, that they won't take just meat or dead animals. So I would use live pigs placed in the back of these traps in order to attract the large cats, and they would then come in and trigger the trap and get caught. So every day I had to go out and feed and water these pigs as well and make sure they were okay and everything was fine with them. In this one case, it happened to be the most remote trap, the furthest from camp, and the pig was very tangled, and I was in a hurry in order to get back and eat breakfast, actually. And I did something I never normally do. I entered the trap from the front entrance instead of feeding the pig from the rear of the trap because I wanted to do it as quickly as possible. And I crawled into the trap, and I hurriedly started to untangle the pig because he had gotten tangled in the rope which attached him to the trap. And I touched and I brushed against the trigger of the trap, and I knew as soon as, in the split second I hit that trigger, I knew that the trap door was going to be coming down within a second. And that's when I had to make some kind of a decision, because I was all alone in the forest. Nobody knew exactly where I was or where this trap was except for me. And we have special locks built on top of the trap so that when the trap door closes, you cannot pick the door back up again, because we've had instances of big cats, tigers, and jaguars using their powerful jaws to open these trap doors. So when you're locked in the trap, if it's strong enough for a tiger, believe me, it's strong enough for a human being to be locked inside and not able to break out. So in the split second, I knew I was going to be trapped, and I had the fear. The only way I can describe it is the fear that must go through an animal's mind, because it was terror. It was terror of being closed in this trap and nobody knowing where I was, or it would have been pitch dark inside of the trap. And I knew I could probably dig my way out eventually, but it could have taken days if I could do it. So what I did is I threw my leg back and took the full brunt of the 40-pound door, which just came straight down. And I knew it would be painful. I didn't expect it to break my leg the way it did, but it actually snapped the bone, and it stopped the door from closing totally, so that the lock for the door didn't engage. So I wasn't trapped in there, but the fear of possibly being trapped in there forced me to do what I knew would be extremely painful, and that was to throw my leg backwards and take the full brunt of that iron door on my leg, which did break. And then I had to try to get back to camp. I was about 4 miles from my camp. And I had to get back through crawling and doing several other things with a broken leg.
So did this have a lot of symbolic value to you when you got trapped by your own trap?
Well, symbolic, I'm not sure that's the word I would use. What it did is it gave me a new awareness, a new appreciation of the fear and terror that these animals must go through inside of these traps. I'm not even sure fear and terror are the right emotions, but eventually what I started doing, because I started wondering just how bad their fear and uncertainty was in these traps, so what I started doing was I hooked radio collars to the trap itself, so that even if they got trapped in the middle of the night and I was sleeping, I would have a radio receiver by my bed turned on, and if the trap got closed, if they got trapped, it would pull a certain magnet off of the radio collar and turn the radio collar on, and I would know they were trapped, so I could go out and get them immediately.
You know, I can't help but wonder what keeps you going on this kind of work. You've been really seriously wounded in action several times. You've broken a leg in a trap. One of the large cats nearly bit off a hand. That's a long story, but I mean, he was very sick and you were trying to help him. You were speared in the foot after a motorcycle accident and had blood poisoning. You were in a plane crash. I mean, I could go on, but you certainly put yourself at risk doing this kind of work, and I would think you'd be ready to retire from it.
Well, actually, I think about that all of the time. My body tells me that I should retire soon, but my mind and my spirit tell me that there's absolutely nothing to retire to, because I see no alternative. My life and my enjoyment comes from being in the wild places with the wildlife. When I get very tired and I come back to see my family in New York, or I go back to the United States, it takes me no more than a week to realize that I want to be back out there in the wilder places, though it's fairly wild in New York as well.
Different kind of wild.
Yes, a more dangerous kind of wild.
Well, Alan Rabinowitz, I wish you good luck in your future work, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Alan Rabinowitz's new book about his study of the wild cats in Thailand is called Chasing the Dragon's Tail. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When John Prine's first album was released in 1971, he was one of the many singer-songwriters to be heralded as the new Dylan. His music survived the label and even survived the near death of popular interest in singer-songwriters. But there seems to be a resurgence of interest in singer-songwriters and in Prine himself. He has his first new studio album in 5 years. We'll listen and talk with him about it. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the latest album by country music star Garth Brooks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. Los Angeles Lakers star Irvin Magic Johnson has tested positive for the AIDS virus and has retired from basketball. In a live broadcast on cable news network, Johnson made the announcement at a Los Angeles news conference this afternoon, where he was upbeat about his situation.
I plan on going on living for a long time, bugging you guys like I've always have. So you'll see me around. I plan on being with the Lakers in the league. And going on with my life. So life is going to go on for me, and I'm going to be a happy man.
Team doctor Michael Melman explained the decision to retire relates to the hectic lifestyle for players in the National Basketball Association.
The rigors of playing professional basketball, to include significant exhaustion on a regular basis, the alterations of normal dietary and activity habits, may impair an individual's immune system. And since this disease also does that, the medical judgment is for Irvin to not continue that.
Johnson says he plans to speak to young people around the country to encourage them to practice safe sex because they sometimes think it can't happen to them. The 12-season Laker veteran told reporters, "Here I am saying it can happen, even to Magic Johnson." The House has overwhelmingly passed a major civil rights bill that makes it easier for victims of job discrimination to sue and collect damages if they prevail. The bill now goes to President Bush, who has said he will sign the measure. House Speaker Tom Foley called the action a historic moment. The legislation has been under debate for 2 years since the Supreme Court issued several rulings in 1989 that made it more difficult for victims of job bias to win lawsuits against their employers. The American Civil Liberties Union has asked the Supreme Court to examine Pennsylvania's abortion law. Ed Ark of member station WITF in Harrisburg reports.
The American Civil Liberties Union has decided to take Pennsylvania's abortion control law to the U.S. Supreme Court. The ACLU's Carol Tracy says they know the risks, but want the issue of Roe versus Wade decided quickly.
The time has come for decision. We must stop the erosion of rights on one hand and the indecision that fosters extremism on the other hand. The question is being called.
2 weeks ago, a federal appeals court upheld provisions of the law requiring a 24-hour waiting period for abortions and parental consent for women under the age of 18. Advocates on both sides of the issue say the appeal will give the nation's highest court a chance to overturn the 1973 landmark decision legalizing abortion. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Ark reporting.
Stocks closed higher on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials gaining 15 points to finish the day at 3054.11. Advances led declines by a margin of about 2-1 and heavy trading of approximately 205 million shares. This is NPR News in Washington. Democrats in the House of Representatives are rallying behind a tax cut proposal which would benefit 90 million Americans. Texas Republican Bill Archer, the ranking Republican on the House Ways and Means Committee, blasted the package and said it would never pass. NPR's Meyer Lyason reports.
The proposal was introduced today by House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dan Rostenkowski. Rostenkowski has been reluctant to agree to a tax cut, but after this week's elections, when voters sent a strong message they wanted some more attention from Washington, he has decided to move forward. The plan would give a $200 to $400 credit to 90 million middle-income taxpayers. The plan would cost $46 billion, but it would make up that loss by raising taxes from 31 to 35% for 1 million Americans who make more than $85,000 a year. Couples who make more than $145,000 would also have their taxes raised. And a 10% surtax would be slapped on millionaires. The tax credit part of the plan is temporary. It would expire after 2 years. But the tax rise is permanent. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Canada's lower house of parliament overwhelmingly passed a gun control bill today that was sparked by the massacre of 14 women at a Montreal university 2 years ago. The law bans the import of military assault weapons, makes it more difficult to obtain gun permits, raises the minimum age for gun ownership from 16 to 18, and tightens storage rules. The legislation must still be approved by the Canadian Senate, where both supporters and opponents vowed to carry on the heated debate that took place in the House of Commons. Health officials in India say at least 100 people have died and as many more are seriously ill from drinking a traditional Hindu tonic. The tonic is an alternative to liquor during the holiday celebrations in that country. It contains as much as 20% alcohol. Hospital officials said some of the seriously ill may survive but lose their eyesight from drinking the bad alcohol. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. John Prine has a new album called The Missing Years. And although the title wasn't intended as a reference to his absence from the recording studio, the truth is a lot of people have lost track of him since the 70s. He made his recording debut 20 years ago. Back then, his anti-war songs, skeptical observations, and his unpolished voice made him one of the many singer-songwriters heralded as the new Bob Dylan. Now Prine is one of the veterans who has kept true to his style no matter what changes were happening in the music scene. Creating his own record label helped him do it. Prine recently ended a concert tour opening for his old friend Bonnie Raitt. This new record is his first studio album since 1986. Here's his song, All the Best.
I wish you love and happiness. I guess I wish you all the best. I wish you don't do like I do. Never fall in love with someone like you. Cause if you feel just like I did, you'd probably walk around the block like a little kid. But kids don't know, they can only guess how hard it is. I wish you happiness.
Did you write this song shortly after separation?
Yeah, I did. I wrote on the road. Actually, I was playing in Charlottesville, and we'd rented an RV to get to the next city, and had a little stove on it, and I was making like tacos at about 65 miles an hour. Of course, I had somebody else driving, and I started writing this song, This All the Best. It all came out like at once. It's not the kind of song you would sit around and think about too much, you know?
Are bad emotional times good songwriting times for you?
Yeah, unfortunately they are.
At least you get something out of the misery.
Yeah, I got a pretty good album out of my first divorce, too. But it's a heck of a way to make a living.
Really? There's something of a revival in the area of acoustic rock and singer-songwriter recordings. Do you feel like that's having an effect on you now?
Well, I guess somewhat it is. I just heard the same thing myself. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known it. You know, everything over the years, like whether or not, regardless of what was really going on in mainstream, fortunately, my music has carried me over. I've had a good bass audience that's come to support me all the time, you know?
I want to play another song from your new record. And this one's called Take a Look at My Heart. It was co-written by John Mellencamp, and there's a backup vocal by Bruce Springsteen. Can you talk about how this song came to be?
Well, I wrote this song about 6 years ago with John Mellencamp. We wrote two songs, and he recorded one. It was called Jackie O. And I've recorded this one like three different times, but I couldn't get it to rock as much as I wanted to. It came out sounding before more like a pretty slick pop song. So I just kept trying it every time I'd go back in to record again.
So what do you do differently on this version of Take a Look at My Heart that makes it more satisfactory to you, more of what you wanted?
Well, Albert Lee came in to play electric guitar on it, and at the same time he laid down like a rock and roll piano rhythm that he could lay his electric guitar over the top of. And he also put some mandolin on there, just rhythm stuff that he could do, would just make it just rock a little bit more. So when he played that beautiful electric guitar on it, the thing really kind of kicked, you know?
Well, this is from John Prine's new album, The Missing Years, and this is Take a Look at My Heart. When you started out, you were known as one of, you know, the new Dylans. How did that way of looking at you affect you?
Well, I thought it was highly complimentary at first, you know. I mean, because Bob Dylan's one of them. He inspired me to start writing in the first place, him and Hank Williams Sr.'s songs did. But they hung that title, that new Dylan thing, on a lot of different people. I think for no particular reason. I don't think they were really looking for a new Bob Dylan. There wasn't anything wrong with the old one.
How did you start writing songs?
Well, my brother taught me a couple of chords when I was 14, and I found it was easier to write songs, or I just called them making up songs, than to try and learn other people's songs. It was just easy for me to put the words together and get a little melody together. I wrote a couple of songs when I was 14 and I put on my second album.
Which songs are those?
The Frying Pan, about the guy that comes home and finds a note in the frying pan that his wife left, and one called Sour Grapes. See, even at 14 I was writing songs about divorce.
When you were writing songs and knew only a couple of chords, did you have to write melodies that would accommodate the couple of chords that you knew?
Yes, I kind of still do. I don't know all that many chords today. I learned most of my guitar playing within those first couple of years. And I prefer simpler melodies, like sometimes I just go for the rhythm of the words. Mm-hmm. Let that dictate the melody. It's almost like listening to somebody talk, how their voice rises and falls.
John Prine is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer-songwriter John Prine. What were the early venues that you got started in? What kind of places?
Oh, geez, let's see. The Earl of Old Town in Chicago. I first started out at a place called the Fifth Peg in Chicago, over in Armitage, across the street from the Old Town School of Folk Music, which was a little scene that was going on. My brother introduced me to, and where a lot of people played folk music and some, like, Appalachian music, and there was this bar across the street that people would meet after school and kind of exchange ideas and that. And that was the first place I ever got up on stage. It was over at the Fifth Peg.
Were you nervous the first few times you performed? I mean, everybody's nervous when they perform at first, but some people feel like they really don't have, you know, what it takes to pull it off.
Well, I didn't think about it too much. I didn't plan on getting up there, and I had a couple of beers, so I was a little bit loose. But when I got up on the stage and that one little spotlight there, because it was a tiny stage, that they shined on me. It was like, it was one of the most comfortable places I'd ever been.
Yeah, why was it comfortable?
I don't know. It's just like I started talking to the people. It was easier to talk to the crowd than it was talking to people one-on-one.
Gee, that's hard to explain, isn't
it? Yeah, I didn't know I was meant for that. You know, maybe if I would have been crossing a road or something and somebody's headlights would have hit me, I would have started telling stories.
Now, I've read that you were discovered at a bar by Kris Kristofferson and Paul Anka, and all I could think about were Kristofferson and Anka at the bar together? I mean, it's such like an unlikely combination of people.
The way the story went is Steve Goodman was opening for Kris Kristofferson his first time that Kris came through Chicago. And Paul Anka, I think, was playing one of the hotels in Chicago, and he liked one of Kristofferson's songs in particular. It was probably Good Times, I guess, and just came over to introduce himself, and that's how all that happened, that they were in one room, and they were telling Steve Goodman how good they thought his songs were, and he should think about perhaps getting a record deal. So Steve said, if you think I'm good, get in a cab, and I'll take you across town to see my buddy. And he brought him over to see me. And within about a month's time, Steve and I were in New York. And I think we were in New York about 26 hours before we both had record contracts.
That's great.
Yeah.
So what did Kristofferson and Anka actually do for you?
Well, Kris just introduced us to a lot of people in the business.
Mm-hmm.
He introduced me to Jerry Wexler over at Atlantic Records. And Paul Anka ended up buying the plane tickets. So Paul was our manager for a while.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, did you have to tell him if you genuinely liked his early records or not?
I never got cornered, Terry.
You must really miss Steve Goodman a lot.
Yeah, I do. I miss him more than ever, now than ever.
Yeah. Let me ask you about one of your early songs. That's one of your best-known songs, and I'm thinking of the song Paradise, which is pretty autobiographical. And Paradise is the name of the town in Kentucky that your parents were born in?
Yes.
And you still had a lot of relatives there when you were growing up, so you'd go and visit there in the summers?
Right.
Why don't we hear this song? This is the original recording from,
great,
from the early 70s.
When I was a child, my family would travel down to western Kentucky where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
I wrote this for my dad.
Well, you wrote it for your dad?
Mm-hmm. Just so he'd know I was a songwriter.
Oh, what was his reaction to the song?
Oh, he loved it. He loved it. When I brought it home on a record after I had my first acetate of it, I brought it home and I got a record player to play it on, and he went and sat. He got up when the song came on and went in the other room and sat in the other room. And when the song was done, I walked in there and I said, how come you walked out of the room when the song came on? He said he wanted to pretend it was on the jukebox.
Oh, that's sweet. That's
yeah.
Really nice.
Yeah.
What are some of your memories of Paradise, Kentucky?
There's about three general stores, and we'd sit on the porch of a general store and shoot pop bottles off of a fence and just walk down the hill and jump in a boat with my grandfather. And there was one black fella in town. His name was Bubby Short. And Bubby and my grandfather were constant companions. Bubby had a great white beard, and he used to tell real funny stories, and they'd take me out fishing with them, buy me an orange soda, pat me on the head, act like I caught the catfish when they caught them.
You still doing a lot of your early songs when you perform now?
Yeah, fortunately, they've worn well with time. You don't ever know that when you're writing them.
Your new album, The Missing Years, is on your own record label, Oh Boy. Why did you decide to start your own label?
Well, I was constantly making, like my entire living is traveling on the road. If my refrigerator breaks down, I gotta go to Kansas City and, you know, sing for 2.5 hours. So I've got that all figured out after about 15 years of doing this. And I figure, well, if I see these people and they come and buy my records and they come and listen to me sing, then why shouldn't I just go directly to them? Because when all the major labels I've ever been on, you can hear them scratching their heads like thousands of miles away, wondering wondering what they're going to do with this animal, John Fry. So I figured I'd save everybody a lot of time and confusion by just being president of my own record label. It's taken us a while to get it distributed well enough so we could compete with the distribution of major labels. And now we've pretty much got it around to that, so it's kind of nice. And also 150,000 records is gold at Oh Boy.
How did you end up calling your label Oh Boy?
Well, it was partially from that Buddy Holly song, All of My Love, All of My Kissing.
Oh, yeah.
That, and also I figured if it was a bad day at Oh Boy, it'd be Oh Boy. And if things were really good, it'd be Oh Boy.
Is there a song from the new record you'd particularly like to go out with?
Oh, yeah. Would you please play The Sins of Mephisto?
Sure. Actually, I was thinking of playing that one anyways.
Great.
Okay, here we go. The Sins of Mephisto from John Prine's new record, The Missing Years.
Of St. Mary to the Count of Monte Cristo, nothing can stop, nothing can stop, nothing can stop the sins of Mephisto. Sally used to play with her hula hoops, now she tells her problems to therapy groups. Grandpa's on the front lawn staring at a rake, wondering if his marriage was a terrible mistake. I'm sitting on the front steps drinking Orange Crush, wondering if it's possible for me to still blush. Oh yeah. A boy on a bike with corduroy slacks sleeps in the river.
John Prine begins a 7-city tour through the Midwest on November 15th. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. I'll talk with a reporter about the devastation in the Philippines from Tuesday's typhoon. Waves of water rolling through the cities there. The problem said to be made worse because of extensive illegal logging in the Philippines. And I'll talk with a young university student from Yugoslavia. Her hometown is Dubrovnik, a city under siege by the Federal Army for more than a month's time. The student is accusing Serbia of controlling the army and of committing genocide against Croatians. Also, letters from listeners about the passing of Broadway producer Joseph Papp, and a request. Please, no more cute cat stories.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Garth Brooks is a one-man symbol of the recent commercial breakthrough in country music. It's rare for a country music album to sell more than 1 million copies, but Garth Brooks' last album, Fences, sold more than 4 million and cracked the pop chart top 10. His new record, Rope in the Wind, is now number 1 on the pop chart. Ken Tucker has a review.
Folks call me a maverick. Guess I ain't too diplomatic. I just never been the kind to go along. Just avoiding confrontation for the sake of confirmation. And I'll admit I tend to sing a different song. Sometimes you just can't be afraid to wear a different hat. If Columbus had complied, this old world might still be flat. Nothing venture, nothing gain. Sometimes you got to go against the grain.
Uh-oh, it sounds like the most popular performer in current country music is starting to believe his own hype. Garth Brooks begins his new album with the vainglorious Against the Grain, talking about how folks call me a maverick, and I ain't no hypocrite, what you see is what you get. What we get is a disturbingly self-satisfied record.
Yesterday she thanked me for oiling that front door. This morning when she wakes, she won't be thankful anymore. She'll never know how much I care, just that I couldn't stay. And
And I'll never know the reason why I always run away. Burning bridges, one by one. What I'm doing can't be undone. And I'm always hoping someday I'm gonna stop this running round. But every time the chance comes up, another bridge goes down.
On his first two albums, Brooks was a sensitive, tough guy who strove to understand the emotions of the women in his songs. He was also a guy who knew how to have fun. He proved that with his big, enjoyably goofy hit single, Friends in Low Places, last year. But on Rope in the Wind, Brooks is more cold and self-centered. In Burning Bridges, the song I just played, he's a heel who talks to his lover about where they're going to settle down. Early the next morning, though, he skips town on her. In Rodeo, his true love ain't no woman flesh and blood, it's that damned old rodeo. Over and over, the songs describe a moody character who'll use any old excuse to avoid making a commitment.
This old highway is like a woman sometimes. She can be your best friend, but she's the real jealous collie. She's the lady that leads me to the life I dream of. And she's the mistress that keeps me from the ones that I love.
The best performances here on What's She Doing Now, The River, and a country rearrangement of Billy Joel's Shameless all showcase Brooks's greatest strength, his ability to fill country ballads with soulful emotions. But most of the time, Rope in the Wind is smug and restrained, and rather chintzy. There's barely more than half an hour of music here. It's as if Brooks thinks he's figured out just what his fans want, and he'll give them that and nothing more. And you know, more would be nice.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. One final note before we close today's Fresh Air. On a recent program, in a review of Paul Fussell's book Bad, or The Dumbing of America, Nova University in Florida was described as a vanity school that hands out PhDs for life experience essays along with lots of cash. This was a mischaracterization of Nova University. We regret the error. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with women comedians from two generations, Joan Rivers and the feminist duo Kathy and Moe. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.